Dickens for today. Scrooge's dead partner, Jacob Marley, speaks. I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Its pattern strange to you, Scrooge? Or would you know the weight and length of the strong coil you bear yourself? It was full as heavy and as long as mine 7 Christmas Eves ago, and you have labored on yours ever since. It is a ponderous chain. Oh, captive, bond, and double-ironed, not to know the ages of incessant labor by immortal creatures, for this earth must pass before the good of which it is susceptible is developed. Not to know that any Christian spirit working kindly in this little sphere, whatever it may be, will find its mortal life too short for us to get its vast usefulness. Not to know that no space of regret can amend or make amends for one's life's opportunities missed. Yet such was I. Oh, such was I. Scrooge. But you were always a good man of business, Jacob. Business, cried the ghost. Mankind was my business. The common welfare, my business, charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. Is Dickens relevant for today? You know, when we think of Dickens, we think of Christmas, and it's kind of interesting because the picture in our American heads is of a Dickensian Christmas. It's England. It's a goose cooking in the kitchen. It's the family gathered around. It's snow falling everywhere. This is a long way from Bethlehem and the first storied Christmas, but it's the one in our heads. And the one in our heads has a certain kind of relevance and value when we revisit the England and the Christmas that Dickens talks about and writes about. And it is a chastening tale. It is the good old days at some level and very, very bad old days also. Days of selfishness and greed and closed hearts. A Christmas Carol is one of our central stories, and it is a very interesting redemptive journey. Now, many of you already know this, but Charles Dickens was a Unitarian, not a UU, only a U. And he converted as an adult and joined Unitarian congregations, and it changed his life and opened up his heart to other people and other cultures. So when, and just as an aside, he created the character Fagin and used the term Jew about 146 times in the first edition, when some of his Jewish friends remonstrated with him and said, you know, it's okay, we understand that this guy was actually modeled on a real person, but you don't have to hit over the head every time. And Dickens changed it and was really open to hearing all levels of pain from all parts of society and amending his own viewpoints. Yes, he was a Unitarian. He had a moral center, but he also listened and reacted to what was going on around him. The story of Scrooge, which is such a part of our lore, is so interesting because it is a redemptive journey. It is a journey from somebody who is closed and heartless towards an epiphany and an opening up of his heart and an opening up of his life. And the interesting and Unitarian thing about it is what's not there. This is not a theological event. The angel Gabriel does not appear to open up his eyes and to put the fear of the Lord into him, nor is Jesus particularly referenced other than the holiday of Christmas. The transformation of Scrooge from this ghost that appears, the ghosts that appear, are opportunities of learning, opportunities to review his life, to see what he has done, the chains that he has forged, and what the world will remember or not remember about him when his life is done. He takes stock of his life and his great wealth and the paucity of spiritual wealth when Jacob comes and kind of drives his legacy up to the door. He may have the Midas touch, but that Midas touch closed and stopped the heart of Midas. In this society, we often deal with the accusation of class warfare, we misuse the term. Dickens touches on it, but not as a revolutionary. The epiphany of Scrooge is not directed at hatred of what he has accrued. It's not about hating wealth. It's about hoarding. It's about being closed. It's about not using the various gifts and treasures that we have to do the business of all humankind. The object in life, despite that old bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys wins," that's not the object of life. The object of life is not to hoard gold or hoard love. Those only come to life when we give them away and share them. Dickens is talking about need, not greed. And that's a really important distinction for our society today to try to make on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. What do we need? What do we need to have? What do we need to give away and share? It isn't about hating people who have been successful. It's about how do we take the treasures that we have inherited or earned or fallen into and make them and ourselves alive. That's the journey of redemption of Scrooge. You know, it's been compared at various times to It's a Wonderful Life, where you have very much the same plot devices, where in A Wonderful Life, the Jimmy Stewart character, in a moment of despair, is shown what the world would have been without his efforts. The efforts, the importance of which he could not see at that moment in his life, and it drove him to despair, to the edge of suicide, because he did not understand how the small things he did, the sacrifices he made, the kindness that he shared, had real results and touched real human beings. In a sense, It's a Wonderful Life is about Bob Cratchit. And if you turned it around and made it more like A Christmas Carol, it would be about Potter, understanding that what am I going to do and how am I going to win just because I have the biggest bank account and the biggest bank, if it's not something useful, if it's not something that does, in that wonderful reading by Howard Thurman, the work of the angels. The work of the angels to feed the hungry, to bring peace among the nations. That's the job there. Now, there's a wonderful game that my son was involved in. It's called Strike That, Reverse It, where you take a story and you turn it around. And the particular challenge of the story that he was given was It's a Wonderful Life. And he sent it to me, so I'm going to pick up paper and read to you, because I'm allowed to distort my own words, but I try to be careful with other people's. So, Strike That, Reverse It. It's a Wonderful Life. Synopsis. George Bailey wants desperately to leave the town of his birth, Bedford Falls, for a life of travel and adventure. But he's called upon to put his dreams aside and care for his family and friends. Through the carelessness of a part of a family member, George is threatened with public and financial humiliation and jail. Determined to commit suicide, George is saved through the intercession of an angel who shows him what his hometown would have become without his efforts. Okay, we all know that story. Now, here's the 21st century rewrite, the best laid plans. Synopsis. The job creator, Mr. Potter, has his plans for modernizing the small community of Bedford Falls thwarted when a fallen angel enlists the help of an ex-high school football star scarred by childhood trauma and frustrated in his ambitions to dupe the townspeople into accepting communism. One wonders how that attitude, so prevalent in neo-Dickensian America today, and if you don't think this is, well, I'll get to that, neo-Dickensian times, Oliver Twist would clearly be seen as a band of ungrateful street urchins, turns on the great institutions of charity of London, and is let loose on London in order to steal from their betters and completely break the hearts of those generous people who were creating workhouses for them. You know, maybe those people had a good idea. If we took these kids who didn't have work habits and took them away from their families and gave them jobs, we could fire the janitors and put them to work cleaning up the school. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's Newt's idea. I'm not making that up. Did you miss that on the news this week? That was his idea. Fire the janitors and hire the kids to do the cleaning. Only the poor kids, right. Because they need work habits. Our kids don't, because they're born with work habits, right? Mine certainly were. I'm sorry, what was that?
He's a great 18th century.
Yeah, that's right. A great 18th century scholar. That's Oliver Twist. It's amazing. And you look at the Christmas Carol. The Christmas Carol is clearly about this lazy Bob Cratchit who wants time off that he doesn't deserve, and he bamboozles the job creator, Mr. Scrooge, into giving it to him, and that leads people to laziness, to the welfare state, and to socialism. That's what's going on. When we look, everything old is new again. We look at this glow of nostalgia at Dickensian times and figure that could never happen again because we've been through it. And our eyes are opened, and we got unions and working conditions and child labor laws and all of those gains that we have assumed to be permanent are up on they're on the table again with people actively and openly, they're not very sneaky, trying to take them all away so that we can go back to having choruses of kids singing Food, Glorious Food without it being a stage play, but a reality. What happened? It really is so astounding to me that we have allowed ourselves to be led into a time when we are not examining our values about ourselves and our society, about what's important. And this is not something that's isolated. I offer to you Black Friday. Black Friday, where we act out the commercialism, the greed, the trickery of commerce, where people are lured into long lines in the middle of the night in order to get to compete for scarce sales for items that they don't tell you there are only four or five, that lose their time with their families and lose their dignity in fighting and competing for all of this stuff, when what is more important to the holiday season than being together with people you care about and people you love and maybe people that you don't even like that much, but you still love them because they're part of your life? To be pulled away from the Thanksgiving table, to have had this march of time backwards from the Christmas, let's call it the Christmas holiday season, and be in this arms race to get the first dollar and the first $100 without examining what is it worth to be at the table with my family. This applies to every class. As we were celebrating our Thanksgiving, there was a young man that needed to leave the table in order to be in line for when the doors opened at 12 o'clock, midnight. What's that about? What does it say about us? I think what it says is that much of our society is leading an unexamined life. This is not a, oh, you're a bunch of sinners sermon. This is about what Socrates talked about, and that is leading an examined life. What's important? How long? I mean, if you get a sense of fun and community, being together all lined up for 12 hours or 20 hours, fine. There are people that do that. I don't judge anybody else's perversity. I have enough trouble with my own. If you dig that, dig that. But understand the price that you pay not to pay a price in dollars. Because the ultimate treasure that we have is not reflected in our bank account. The ultimate treasure is what is reflected in the heart, in the love that we give, that we make, that we receive, in the people whom we touch. We would all much rather, I believe, be George Bailey than Mr. Potter. We would, if we don't want to exactly be Robert Cratchit, we would prefer to be Robert Cratchit than Scrooge, at least before his epiphany, because we need to talk about and think about and choose those values that bring our hearts to life and not harden our hearts through unexamined choices. Now, I'm not anti-gift. Anybody in this congregation that wants to give me something, I'm happy. I'm not anti-commercialism. My father was in the retail business. We celebrated Christmas. We celebrated Christmas because in December, my parents both went to the store in Inglewood. And instead of closing at 5:30, they closed at 9:30. And I didn't see my parents for the month of December. And so Christmas morning was a time of great celebration. And we were celebrating, yes, the commercial success of the business, but as kids, we were celebrating the return of our parents. Before we caught the commercial bug, we understood that the meaning of the holidays was about family, was about things of much more enduring value than the various gifts that we gave each other. Gifts are symbols of caring. They are not substitutes for the actual caring. When we think about need versus greed, when we think about what it is that we care about and the most precious commodity that we have, which is our time, then we can start putting these things in order and understand what the great gifts are, what the spirit of the season could and should be. When we look at this neo-Dickensian world that we live in right now, where there is the widest disparity in our history between the CEOs and the average workers, when we look at executives who are giving bonuses for failure, who ship jobs overseas, fire American workers, and with the money saved, pay themselves bonuses, you don't have to be a moral saint to understand that there's something wrong here. But we've been here before. And so this is not a downer sermon. This is something that says Dickensian England had some warm spots to it, had some learning, and was part of the process of change. But change and gains are never permanent. Every generation or two, as John Kennedy said, we have to re-earn our freedom, re-examine and reassert our values. They are not self-perpetuating. And the great lesson of Dickensian England is not how bad it was, but that it got better and people changed it. Didn't happen automatically. It didn't happen through passivity. It happened through people coming together and organizing and caring and trying to change their values and their needs into programs. That view won, and that's the hope. It can win again, because it is the time for this generation to assert our values, our goals, our compassion, in order not to win a permanent victory — there are no permanent victories — but in order to claw back those gains that have been eroded. This is a season of hope, a season that we celebrate the fact that the sun grows small and dim and cold and seems to die. But the promise of Hanukkah, the promise of Christmas, is that the light still glows. The flames will return. The warmth will return. And we can return to better days where our values become incarnate in programs that are of service, that perfect this world, that reach out our values and our hearts and our efforts to all humankind, not just ourselves, but all of us on our planet.